Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kafei Amud Aleph. The Gemara is in the middle of an Agadah Torah, and it's actually going to jump tracks to something that has no connection at all. And that is because what's typical in an Agadah Torah is that the similar Amoraim or Tanaim that are mentioned in the previous sequence also mentioned in this sequence, and that's what we have here. That the psukim they were about to explain, the same machlokel that we had before with the Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani and Rabbi Elazar, also appear over here. And for that reason, the Gemara jumps over to these other agadatot. And that is at the top of Chafei Amud Aleph. It begins with a pasuk from Yoshua. Vayidom HaShemesh VeYareach Amad Ad Yekum Goy Oivav Alohi Ktuva HaSefer Yashar. So this references to the incident with Yoshua when he's fighting against the Malkei Canaan and he wants to finish off the battle. Remember, in their day, they only fought during the day. They didn't fight at night. There was no way to see. There was no way to really fight at night. So all the battles took place during the day. And Yeshua wants to finish off the battle, but the day or the time of the day is running out. So he asks Hashem, Shemesh b'givon dom, b'yareach b'emek ayalom. He makes the request of Hashem that the sun should stand still and wait so they can finish off the battle on that day. What did happen was, v'yidom Hashemesh v'yareach amad, the sun went silent, which as Rashi notes over here, that the sun in general, when it's moving, it is singing Shira. So when it's Vayidom, we usually refer to Vayidom as to fall silent. So over here, what does it mean that the Shemesh fell silent? It means it stopped singing Shira because it was no longer moving through the sky. And Rashi notes over here, Yoshua omer Shira bishvila. And then Yoshua fills in and does the Shira for it. Isaac deber Yoshua l'Hashem v'yom teit Hashem. Then Yeshua himself speaks up and replaces or supplants the Shira of the Shemesh. And Yeshua is given time then to finish off the battle and to finish off the Malkei Canaan. And so that also thematic connection to the previous Gemara about the Shira. The Gemara wants to know here two things. One is, what is the Sefer Yashar? And number two is, how long did the sun stand still for? Amar Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my Sefer Yashar, what is the Sefer Yashar over here? Amar Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, this Sefer Abraham, Yitzchak, V'Yakov, Shenikru Yisharim. That's a reference to Sefer Bereishit, which has the stories of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who are called the Yisharim. Shenamar, the pasuk that's found by Bilam when he is prophetically speaking about his hope for what will happen to him when he passes away. Tamut nafshi mot yisharim. That I should pass away and I should face the same death as the yisharim. That's a reference to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. As Rashi says over there, shimot mita shel gvi'ah. He'll pass away in a natural way, Hashem taking the soul of the individual. Ve'hecha remiza. So now if you say that he is referencing back to Sefer Bereishit, where is the hint, remez in Sefer Bereishit that indicates that Yoshua will act in this way? It says that Shemesh and the Reach stopped, like it is written in Sefer Yashar. Now you're telling me Sefer Yashar means like it's written in Sefer Bereishit. Where in Sefer Bereishit does it predict anything like this? And that is by the Brocha of Ephraim, it says, V'zaroyem lo hagoyim. That his offspring, his descendants will be amongst all the nations, or fill all the nations, or be known to all the nations. And that happens here, where Yoshua, who is from Shevet Ephraim, when he causes the sun and the moon to stop, everybody knows about it. Because it's one thing when you're battling locally, but if you stop the sun and the moon, everybody in the world knows that something happened because it's obvious to everyone. When will he be amongst all the nations or everyone will be aware of him? The time that the sun stood still for Yehoshua. The sun stood still in the middle of the sky. And it did not proceed to go like a normal day or a full day. So from here, most of the Rishonim point out that there were two stops here for the sun. One of them is Bechatzi HaShemayim, in the middle of the sky the sun stopped. And then there's a second stop, which is Lo Atzlavo. It did not proceed to set, which means right before it set, it also seems to have stopped. Ki Yom Tamim, and Yom Tamim is modifying the amount of time that is associated with the other two. And from that, we have the Machloket, which connects this back to the previous Gemara, which is that we have those same individuals who were mentioned in the previous Agadah to also appear over here. And the argument as to how to explain this Pasuk. V'kamo, how long did it stop for? I'm Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Esrim v'arba Asha'e, a total of 24 hours. Ozil Shit, it went 6 hours. It went 6 hours into the day, which is noon. Kam Shit, It stalled there for 6 hours. Azoshit, then went another 6 hours, which would bring it to sunset. Bekamshit, and then it stood again, or it stalled again for another 6 hours. Kula milta kiyom tamim. The entirety of that day was like a full day. A full day would be 24 hours. So instead of the 24 hours being night and day, in that instance, the day itself was 24 hours. The normal 12 hours, plus the 12 hours of ikuv. And so what he says is that the Yom Tamim is modifying the entirety of the sun being around. And that day was Kiyom Tamim. Belazar Amar Shloshim Vishit. It was 36 hours. Ozo Shit Bekam Treisar. It goes 6 hours till noon. And then it had to stop for 12 hours. Ozo Shit went towards sunset. Bekam Treisar. And then waited 12 hours. Amidato Kiyom Tamim. So he says the Yom Tamim is not modifying the day itself, but rather the two Ikuvim, the two times that it stopped, were 24 hours. So he says it was 12 hours and 12 hours with the stops, means the totality of the day was 36 hours. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani Amar, 48. It was a 48-hour day. Azoshit, it went 6 hours, went to noon, Kam Shesar, and then it stalled for 12. Azoshit, Vikam Esrim Barba, and then went another 6 hours before sunset, stalled for 24 hours. Shinamar, Velo Atzlavo, Kiyom Tamim. He says the Yom Tamim is only modifying Lo Atzlavo. The stall at sunset was for 24 hours, Kiyom Tamim. And so then he had a 24-hour stop. Bichlau, Demikar Alav, Kiyom Tamim Hava. And that implies, or the inference you would draw, was that the first stop wasn't 24 hours. And then Rashi says over here, and it was 12 hours, because that's your standard period of time. It's a night. And so you assume that when it stopped that period of time. So the 12 hours was the first stop, and then there were 24 hours in the second stop. Plus the regular 12 hours of the day, you get to 48-hour day on that day. Ikadamre, there's some that say, bitosefta plike, that they're not arguing about the entirety of the day, the duration of that whole day, but rather simply about the additional hours that were added to that day. Therefore, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi amar esrim ba'arba'a. He says that there were 24 hours added to the day. Azoshit v'kam treisar. It went 6 hours and stalled for 12. Azoshit went another 6 hours towards sunset, became tracer, and then stalled for 12 hours. Amidato kiyom tamim. So there, the stalling was for 24 hours, and that's kiyom tamim, and that's why you have 24 hours plus 12 is a totality of 36 hours. Azar amar shloshim v'sheish, that it stalled for 36 hours. Azoshit became tracer, goes 6 hours till noon, and then stalls for 12. Azoshit became asrim v'arba, then it goes another 6 hours towards sunset and stalls for 24 hours. Below that, Slavok Yom Tamim. The Yom Tamim is a reference to the stalling right before sunset. And that stalling was Ki Yom Tamim, implying that the other stalling beforehand was not Ki Yom Tamim, but rather 12 hours, a standard block of time. And Rashi says that, Kamaita, the Lok Tidbe Ki Yom Tamim, Stam Amida, Shema Sashot. Standard stall is 12 hours. Ki Amida, Shedarko La'amod, B'lishtok Balayla. The standard amount of time that it's not around during the night. So there's a standard period of the sun not being there is 12 hours, because that's the overnight period where the sun is not present. So if you have to decide what's the standard, if it doesn't tell you 24, then 12 hours is that standard stall. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani amar 48, that it's 48 hours. Azoshit became asrim v'arba, went 6 hours, stalled for 24. Azoshit became chavdalit, went another 6 hours, stalled for 24. Mikisha midato the biato. He makes that case between the stall at sunset to the stall during noon. Ma biato kiyom tamim, afa midato kiyom tamim. Just like at the sunset it was kiyom tamim, so too the earlier period was also kiyom tamim. So now the numbers that they express are the same in both cases. It's 24, 36, and 48. In the first case, it referenced to the totality of the day. That means the amount of period it stalled plus the day itself. So in the first case, 24 hours meant 12 hours of stall plus the 12 hours of the day. In the second version, 24 hours was just the stall period. That means it was 24 hours plus 12, it would be 36. So in the second explanation, their numbers for the total day are 36, 48, and 60 hours, which would be the amount of time that is encompassed by the entirety of the day based on the second opinions. Tano, Kishem Shamdalo Chamal Yeshua, Kach Amdalo Chamal Moshe, Ulanakdimon Ben Gurion. Similar to the fact that the sun stopped for Yeshua, we have two other incidents in history where the sun stopped. One was by Moshe Rabbeinu, and the other one is by Nakdimon Ben Gurion. Where it says Yeshua cry, Yeshua is explicit in the Psukim. Nakdimon Ben Gurion Gemara is a Mesorah that's brought in the story in the Gemara in Tanit, which we'll discuss, and Moshe Minolon. And the Gemara wants to know where Moshe comes from. Now already, the Balei HaTosafot and other Rishonim ask, aren't there other cases where we have the sun stops or rises early or moves for an individual, including the stories by Yaakov Avinu. By Yaakov Avinu, it set early for him when he was going to Haran in order to stop him by the Har Moriah. Shem says, how could he pass by my bayit and not make a stop over here? Therefore, he caused the sun to set early. And then we also have by Yaakov, after his fight with the Malach, that by Yizrach Lo HaShemesh, that his sun rose early for him over there. And then the story in the Agadato of Achelek, Daf Tzadik Vov, in Sanhedrin, over there it discusses about the sun, that the sun stopped for Chizkiyahu HaMelech. But Balei HaTosafot want to know, what happened to these individuals? Why weren't these individuals mentioned, as opposed to just the three that we have in the Gemara? So the Ravid actually answers that there's a difference. In this case, it was Amad HaShemesh. In these three instances, the sun stalled and stopped in the sky. And the other incidences, it either rose early or set early, but it wasn't that it was Amad HaShemesh, that the sun stopped. So that's how the Ravid deals with it. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot explain that with regards to Yaakov, it was not an incident to mention because they offset each other. The sun set early by his case when he's going to Haran, and then it rose early when he was Soleya al-Reicho after he had the fight with the Malach at Peniel to offset each other, and it was just to make whole on the sun setting early the other time, was it rising this time? Which implies, and which would be very difficult, that there was no make whole for what happened in the time of Yeshua, Moshe, and Nagdimon Ben Gurion, which would then throw the calendar off, and it'd be very difficult to understand how it squares away with calculations of things like the Molad and other things like that, because you've had a change in the daytime hours and the sun moving, which would have changed everything about the calendarical system. So Rav Tosafot says that case was a case where it was offsetting. And for the same reason, by Chizkiyah it doesn't mention it. Shelo hayu rak tashlumim. It was just to make up the time for the day that was shorted in the time of Achaz, his father. So then in Chizkiyah's time, they extended the day. And so those are offsetting cases as well. And then the Rabbeinu Elchanan Omer, and you should know that there is on Masechet Avodah Zarah, Tosafot Rabbeinu Elchanan. It's a separate Balei HaTosafot, like we have another Masechto, Tosafot, the Tosafot Anglia, we have the Tosafot Rabbeinu Peretz, the Tosafot Shantz, the Tosafot Arosh. We have other Tosafot that are separate from the Balei HaTosafot that are found here. In the Gemara here in Avodah Zarah, many times they're quoting in Rabbeinu Elchanan. There's actually a separate sefer called the Tosafot Rabbeinu Elchanan, which many people reference to here in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. But here the Rabbeinu Elchanan says, "Domaisa de Chizkiyah lo yala ot ba'alma." It was just a sign. Shreilo amad Hashemesh klal b'makom achadah shalach achurav. It wasn't that the sun stood still, the sun backed up. Whether it was an illusion or some sort of imagery that it moved back, but it wasn't really that the sun had stood still or stopped. This has ringings of what the Ravid said, which is it's a different type of miracle rather than what we're seeing here, which was amad Hashemesh. So now here again, we have three incidences where the sun stopped. We have the incident of Yoshua, which is explicit in the Psukim, which we just discussed, of Shemesh v'Givon Dom, v'Yareach v'Emek Ayalon. We have the case of Nagdimon ben Gurion, which is a famous story that's brought in the Agadato in the Gemara in Ta'anit, whereby the Olei Regel were short on water. There was no rain that year. It was a huge drought. And everyone was coming up to Yerushalayim, and there was no water. So Nagdimon ben Gurion buys water, or basically borrows water from this non-Jewish hegemon. He bought 12 cisterns full of water in a year of drought that was extremely expensive. And he said that he had to return the water by a certain date. And if he didn't return the water by that date, then he would owe him a 12 kikar kesef, a kikar kesef for each cistern, which was an exorbitant amount of money. Nagdima Ben-Gurion was one of the three Ashirei Yerushalayim, was extremely wealthy. And he pledged his own money for the Olei Regel to have water. And it came to that day, the Hegmon says to him, listen, there's no rain, no water, you're not returning this water, start to pay up. He says, I still have the day left. It's the morning. At Mincha time again, he came to him, he says, the day's not over, I still have time. So then the Hegmon went into the bathhouse to go celebrate his good fortune that he's about to make a lot of money. And Nachtima Ben-Gurion went into the Beit HaMikdash to daven, and he beseeches Hashem that I didn't do this for my own honor, the honor of my family, I didn't do this for my personal benefit. I did this for your honor and for the Olei Regalim, for Kvod Yisrael. And then all of a sudden, the clouds appear, and it starts to pour with rain, and the cisterns are refilled by the time. So then they come out and meet Nakdima Ben Gurion and this Hegmon. And Hegmon says, you know, I know that it only rained because God listened to you and brought the rain, but the only problem is the sun has set. You look up, it's dark out, and the rain came into my cisterns when they were mine, and it's past the date that you have the right to do it. So I own the rain, and you owe me the money. Then Nakdima Ben Gurion went back to the Beit HaMikdash and davened, and all of a sudden, it Pazru Ananim, the clouds dissipate, and the sun is shining. And the Hegmon says again, I know that Hashem only did this for you, but basically Hashem brought the sun back out, or stalled the sun, so that the rain could refill the cisterns for Nakdima Ben Gurion, and then he'd be able to return it without having to pay the money. So that's the Gemara, that's the Mesorah that was brought, and the sun stopped for Nakdima Ben Gurion. The Moshe Minalan. The question is, with regards to Moshe, where do we have evidence of the fact that the sun stopped for Moshe Rabbeinu? So that the Gemara brings from a Pasuk in Dvarim, Perek Bet, Pasuk Kafei. It says, Ayom Azeh, Achel Tei Pachtecho Biratcha Pnei Amim, Tachat Kol HaShemayim. On this day, your fear and awesomeness will be known to all the nations under the heavens. Asher Yishmu'un Shimacha, when they hear your name, Viragzu, they will tremble with Chalumi Panecha, and they will be fearful from your face, meaning that they'll run away from you. So over here you have a pasuk that indicates that Moshe is world renowned. As Rashi says over here, when a person fights a battle, the battle is local. Somebody in Spain has no idea what's going on with the battle that's happening in Eifer Yardin with Moshe Rabbeinu and with Og Melech HaBashan or with Sichon Melech HaEmori. So how do other people know about the battle? And it's similar to what he says by Yoshua. The only way people know about your battles and it's happening if something happens that's extreme in the heavens that other people are aware of. So that's why Chazal many times speak about with regards to Kriyat Yamsuf. The Midrash says that not only was there water split by Kriyat Yamsuf, but all the waters of the world split. What they're trying to do in that Agadato is say that it became a world-renowned event. How does something become world-renowned? That the same thing happened here, happens everywhere, so everybody's aware of it. So they take Kriyat Yamsuf and say, oh, it happened here, it happened everywhere, and everybody was aware of it. Similarly, with regards to the Matan Torah on Har Sinai, how does everybody know about it? It's a world-renowned event. How does that happen? Is that either the thunder and the lightning and all the sound and light show is available to everyone, or they hear it? Or that Hashem goes before he went to Har Sinai and proposes the Torah to everyone so they become aware of it. So in all those instances, you have something that makes it world-renowned. And similarly over here, what the Gemara is saying is that how is it that Moshe Rabbeinu is world-renowned? There must have been something that happened that makes him world-renowned, even though it's a local battle. And that is, Acha Achel Achel, Tivach Achel Tei Pachtecho, Tivatam Yoshua, Achel Gadelcha, that today I'm going to start to make you great, which is found in Yoshua, Perikimo, Pasuk, Zayin. And so now they connect between the Achel of Yoshua to the Achel of Moshe Rabbeinu, and say, just like by Yoshua, the sun stopped, and that's what makes him great. So too, by Moshe Rabbeinu, that's what makes him great. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Atya Tate, Tivach Achel Tate Batcha to Yoshua, Biyom Tate Hashem et Emori, on the day that Hashem will give the Emori into your hand. So again, Tate, the Gemara says, got a reserve shav to say that the sun stopped in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now over here, Rashi indicates that it was in the battle with Sichon that the sun stopped in his explanation as to when this happened and which battle happened. Although if you look at Rashi's Perush on Chumash, there Rashi says, Tachat kol ha-shamayim, b'meid, shamdam chamal Moshe b'yom milchamet Og, b'noda davar tachat kol ha-shamayim. That happened in Milchamet Og, over here in the Chumash that I'm looking at, Svarim Acherim Sichon. And if you look in the context of the psukim that you're speaking about here, it seems to be speaking about Sichon, because just a couple psukim later it says, "V'lo avas Sichon melech Heshbon harieni bo ki yakshah shel mekechad ruchol v'meitz levavol demanti tov yatcha kayom hazeh." So contextually, it seems to be speaking about Sichon melech Hamori, and the next pasuk and the next parshia begins, "Ayom Hashem alai reichal chaloti teit lepanechat Sichon v'etarzo chel rash lereshet etarzo." So in contextually, it all seems to be speaking about Sichon. And that's what Rashi explains here in the Gemara, that it was in the battle with Sichon, though in the Chumash, it mentions that it was in the battle with Og. So now, Rav Shmuel, Mar Nachmani Amar, Migufei Dekrash, might let you can see it from the Pasuk itself, That's the pasuk that we read before, that your name will become world renowned and everybody will be fearful and in awe of you. When was there such an event by Moshe Rabbeinu? That's when the sun stopped for Moshe. So again, here we have a machloket, including Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani, as to how to explain the Agadato, or the source for the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu had the sun stop for him, like Yoshua Bin Nun. Now, what's interesting about this is that Chazal over here say that it happened for Moshe Rabbeinu, just like it happened for Yoshua. I think a part of what's driving that is that Yoshua is a Talmid of Moshe Rabbeinu, and we know that Chazal say that Pnei Moshe k'pnei Achama, Pnei Yoshua k'pnei Ayareach, and Moshe's face had the radiance, it was like that of the sun, and Yeshua was that of the moon. Meaning that Yeshua was a derivative of Moshe, or that Yeshua was the Talmud of Moshe Rabbeinu. And so here, if you have such a world-renowned, unbelievable event of the sun stopping and the moon stopping that happens in the time of Yeshua, you would expect that something similar happened in Moshe Rabbeinu's time, because Yeshua is a Talmud, or he is a lesser stature than that of Moshe Rabbeinu. And we find a similar idea when Elisha and Eliyahu, when Elisha asks for Pishnayim v'nivuat Eliyahu, then we see that whatever Eliyahu had done, Elisha does. And then Elisha, on top of that, does other things in order to get the Pishnayim. But there, specifically, he had to ask for Pishnayim. Otherwise, we would have assumed that he does the things that his Rebbe did, which are very similar. There's similar stories between them about Tchiyat HaMetim, for a young child who they basically sponsor or take care of. There are many incidents or events that take place where Elisha does exactly or is in the same circumstances as his Rebbe Eliyahu. So that's what you would expect, and I assume that partly is what driving over here, that if it happened in Yeshua, it must be something that happened in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu as well. Meitevei, the Pasuk in Yeshua, Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Dalet, which is right after the Pesukim that we started the Daf with today, it says, V'lo yaka yomahu lefanav v'acharav. Says there was never such a day beforehand and afterwards. So you have these types of statements, for instance, by the Arbe in Mitzrayim, that there was never such an Arbe. The problem is that when you look in Navi and Yoel, there is such an incident. So there Chazal have to differentiate between the incidences to say that it's not the same. And the Gemara has to do the same thing over here, which is it says by Yoshua, never happened before, never happened afterwards. Well, if it happened in the time of Moshe, how do you make a statement like that? The sun stopped for Yeshua much longer duration than it did for Moshe Rabbeinu. So that'll be the difference. The battle with Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe it was the same duration, maybe the sun stopped in the same amount of time, but there was an additional factor by Yeshua, which is in Perek Yod, Pasuk Yod Aleph, which explains right before the Shemesh B'Givon Dome, it says, "Vehi bin nusamit mipnei Yisrael." When they ran away from Bnei Yisrael, these are the Machay Canaan. Heim b'morad Beit Horon. They were descending the descents of Beit Horon. Hashem ishlich alem avanim gedolot min hashamayim ad azeka. Hashem poured upon them hailstones or stones from the heavens all the way down to azeka. Vayamutu, and they died. But not only was there this incident of the Shemesh B'Givon Dome, Yerech B'Yam Alon, but also God was fighting Min HaShamayim on their behalf. There were these Avnei Barad that were coming down, or Avanim Gedolot that were coming down, and killing the enemy as the enemy was retreating or fleeing the attack of Bnei Yisrael. So that's what makes Yeshua as uniquely different than that of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why it says, there was no such battle with Fanav V'Acharav, not just about the sun stopping, but also the fact that the stones came down and aided Yoshua in the battle. Tiv vayomer lelamed bnei Yehuda kashet hinei ktuva sefer yashar. So it's another pasuk that's brought in Shmuel Bet. This is in David's hesped for Shaul. So in the beginning of the kinah, the eulogy for Shaul, it says, "Vikonein David et hakinah hazot al Shaul v'al Yonatan beno." Then he begins, "Vayomer lelamed bnei Yehuda kashet hinei ktuva sefer yashar." So the Mitzvah of David over there says, before he wants to begin the kina, the eulogy, Rala makes the boat on a shav, the vayerech lebabam, trying to give hope and strength to those that are gathered there, that even though the plishtim defeated Joel and killed Joel, then in the future we're going to have hope. And it says, Vayomer lelameid b'nei Yehuda kashet. Nevertheless, Yehuda is well prepared
Whether that means that they were already well-versed or lelamed, they need to be taught and to take up the koshet. But you see that David is encouraging Bnei Yehuda to become archers or utilize their archery in the battles, and they should take heart in that.
It's written in Sefer Yashar. My Sefer Yashar. Again here, what is this Sefer Yashar? Rabbi Chiya ba'Av and Rabbi Yochanan, this Sefer Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. Similar to what we saw above, Rabbi Chiya ba'Av and Rabbi Yochanan says, this is Sefer Breishit. Shenikru Yisharim, because Abraham Yitzchak and Yaakov are called the Yisharim Dichtei Behu, because by Bilam, again, Tamot Nafshi, Mot Yisharim, Uti Achriti Kamohu, that I should die like the death of the Yisharim, and my end should be like their end. And he's asking for the mitah of the avot. Beicha remiza. If you tell me that it was mentioned in Sefer Breishit, where is there a hint in Sefer Breishit to the fact that the Bnei Yehuda are going to be the archers and they're going to be involved with the kashet? It says Yehuda, ata yuducha achecha, yadcha ba'oref oivecha. It says Yehuda, your brethren will admit to you, meaning that they will submit to your leadership. And then, yadcha ba'oref oivecha, your hand will be at the neck of your enemy. Yad keneged oref. What type of battle requires a hand opposite the neck? Rabbi Meir, zo keshet. That is an archer or a bow and arrow. Rashi explains it like you just demonstrated, which is, the person who is the archer, he has to hold up the bow, and then when he pulls his hand back to tighten the string, or to make the string taut, to release the arrow, his hand moves back towards Oref, moves back towards the back of his neck. The Marsha says that doesn't fit the puzzle. The puzzle says, Yadcha be'oref oivecha. Says your hand will be at the back of the neck of your enemy, not your own neck. And there the Marsha says, Lulei divrei Rashi, if it was not for what Rashi said, I would explain the Gemara in the following way, which is that what is the weapon which you use when the enemy is fleeing, and then the archer takes his arrow and he shoots it and he hits Oref Oivecha, that he launches the arrow into Oref Oivecha, that's Yadcha Ba'oref Oivecha. That's how your hand touches the back of the neck. That's when they're fleeing, you're shooting the arrows at them as they're fleeing. And the Marsha even adds that the hand that it holds the bow has to be leveled at Oref Oivecha. That's Yadcha Oref Oivecha. It guides the arrow to the back of the neck of the Oivim, and that's how he explains the hint from the Pasuk in Sefer Breishit. This is David speaking to his men, or to those that are gathered with him. David HaMelech is from Shevet Yehuda, and this is the beginning of the dynasty that will then extend from Shevet Yehuda to have all the kings from Shevet Yehuda. And he's saying to his brethren from Yehuda, that even though Shaul has passed away, but Lamed Bnei Yehuda Koshet, Hinei Ketuva Sefer Yashar. David is encouraging Bnei Yehuda to become archers or utilize their archery in the battles, and they should take heart in that. Now we know from Sefer Breishit, David is referencing to that Pasuk, Yadcha Ba'oref Oivecha, to instill a certain amount of morale in his troops and to say, we're going to succeed and we are going to conquer the Plishtim. Lezer Omer, Zes Sefer Mishnah Torah. Sefer Yashar is not Sefer Breishit, but rather it's Sefer Dvarim. But my karule Sefer Yashar. What makes it the Sefer Yashar? Tichtiv, because the Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, Pashat et Hanan, after Matan Torah, it says, Vasita Yashar Vato Beinei Hashem. And you have to do that which is good and just in the eyes of Hashem. And so there you see the word Yashar, a reference to in Sefer Dvarim, and therefore he calls it the Sefer HaYashar, which is interesting because here you have one word, and all of a sudden it becomes Sefer Yashar. By Sefer Breishit, you're speaking about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who are the Yisharim. So that makes sense to call it Sefer Yashar, because Sefer Breishit is all about the lives of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Over here you have one Pasuk in Dvarim, and now you're going to call it Sefer Yashar. So this might back up what the Ramban of the Torah says by Vasita Yashar Vatov. He says there are certain mitzvot in the Torah, which are these all-encompassing instructions as to how one conducts their life. One of those examples the Ramban gives is Kedoshim Tiyu. That's found in Sefer Vayikra. And then for that reason, maybe we'd call Vayikra Sefer HaKedoshim. Because that pasuk is an overarching thing, which means that your whole life should be infused with Kedusha. Everything you do in life, you should be Kedoshim. That's how the Ramban reads the mitzvah of Kedoshim to you. And here too, he reads the Pasuk Vasita Yashar Tov as being an overarching instruction as how one should act. And Ramban says that the Torah and the Gemara are replete with case law, and cases and issues and instances that come up. But he says that the Torah can never cover everything that's going to happen. The Torah can never cover every single situation between parties, every single situation that will face an individual. And so therefore the Torah gives you a line that says, this is the principle that should govern everything you do, and that is Vasita Yashar V'Atov. Vasita Yashar V'Atov is the overarching principle by which one should conduct their life. And if you have any questions about what to do, it's Vasita Yashar V'Atov. That should guide you. And we found in the Gemara in Baba Metzia, Vasita Yashar V'Atov, the Gemara invokes that as a principle, when the letter of the law does not govern the situation, we say, Lifnim Yeshurat Adin, that the spirit of the law would indicate that one should behave in this way. And that's how the Gemara musters Vasita Yashar V'Atov to say that's the spirit of the law and one should act in this way because that's the right thing to do. And that's what the Ramban says. That should be the governing principle of everything we do in life, is that it should be just and right. And that's Vasita Yashar V'Atov. And in that way, that would give the feeling that that is the overarching theme of Sefer Dvarim, which is you do Vasita Yashar V'Atov. It's not just a single pasuk. It's a puzzle that carries a tremendous amount of weight in its guiding principle. Beicha remiza, well, if it's in Sefer Dvarim, where is that hinted to? Yadav Ravlo, Beizer Mitzarav Tiyeh. Beizer Milchoma Shetzricha Shte Yadayim. It says Yadav, in plural. Which battle do you require two hands for? Rabbi Omer Zokeshet. That is someone who's an archer. A person who's fighting with the sword generally only fights with one hand. They can't fight with two hands. But generally they're holding a shield in one hand and a sword in the other hand. Whereas the archer needs two hands. One to guide the bow and the other one to pull back the arrow to shoot it. That's battle that involves two hands. So again here we see the same individuals who are arguing about the explanation of the psukim. And that's why this agadato appears here, even though it's not necessarily thematically connected to our Gemara at all. Amar zeh sefer shoftim. V'amai karile sefer yashar. Why would you call it Sefer Yashar? Because there's a pasuk that repeats itself a couple of times in Sefer Shoftim, and it does give you the theme of Sefer Shoftim, which is the theme. Bayimim Mahim and Melech B'Israel. During those days, there was no king in Israel. Ish Hayashar Be'enav Yaseh. Everybody did what they wanted to do. It was a free-for-all during Sefer Shoftim. And that's the problem in Sefer Shoftim. There's no real leadership, and everybody's doing as they please. And again, that's thematically persistent throughout Sefer Shoftim. And that's why here a single pasuk, actually the pasuk appears a couple of times, it would be the theme or the name of the Sefer is Sefer Yashar. Isha Yashar Be'enav Yaseh. People did whatever they wanted. Beichen Remiza. And where is it hinted in Sefer Shoftim? Because it says in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim when they, Ve'el goyim asher niach Hashem l'asod b'nei Yisrael et kol asher lo yad'u et kol milchamot kinan rak l'man da'at torot b'nei Yisrael l'lamdam milchama rak asher lefanim lo yida'um. So he left over these individuals so b'nei Yisrael would have practice or be engaged in milchama because they weren't involved in the original battles for the conquest of the land. So they're left behind in order to cause problems for them and to engage them so that they will have to be practiced and well-versed in battle. Is a milchama shetzricha limud? What type of battle requires learning or being taught? What is a skill set that you really need? Rabbi Omer, zo kashet. That is the archery. As opposed to fighting with the sword, which also requires a certain amount of skill, but one can go out and use a sword just by their brute force or by their strength. You don't have to be taught how to use a sword. You might have to be taught how to fight with the sword and to work with the sword, but anybody can pick up a sword and do damage or fight with the sword. Archery doesn't work that way. If you try to shoot an arrow and you have no idea what you're doing, you won't get very far. You probably hurt yourself more than you hurt anybody else. And for that reason, it speaks about teaching a battle means teaching someone how to be an archer. Umin lalan de Yehuda k'tiv. How do you know that that is written about Yehuda? Because that's in Perek Gimel of Sefer Shoftim. And who are we speaking about when we speak about well-versed in battle? Those are the individuals who are going to be at the front, the ones who are leading. And that is Shevet Yehuda, which we know from Perek Aleph. Because in Perek Aleph, in Shoftim, when it speaks about them going out to battle, it says, Diktim, Vayi acharei mot Yoshua, v'yishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem le'mor, mi yalenu lanu el haknani batchila, l'lachem bo, who's going to fight against the Knani first? Who's going to be the first Shevet to go out? That Yehuda should be the first one to go out. You see that in Perek Aleph, when it spoke about who's going to be the first Shevet, who's going to lead the battles,
It says that Yehuda will be in front, and they should go first to lead the battles. And then they speak about Yehuda's conquests, where they conquered the areas of Hebron, even the areas of Yerushalayim, it seems, at least in Sefer Shoftim. And then they go further up north, and they go with Shevet Shimon. Between them, they conquer large areas all the way up to Beit Shan and further north. And then in Perek Gimel, when it speaks about the cycles of the Shoftim and what happens in Sefer Shoftim, it says, Laman dat torot b'nei Yisrael lamda milchama. So that they have the capacity or the ability to go to battle. That teaching of how to go to battle obviously references back to what we were starting about, who's going to be the lead when it comes to the battles is Yehuda. And that's how we know there is an association between Yehuda and archery. What's interesting about that is that if you look in the end of Sefer Shoftim, and if you look in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the majority of the archers actually came from Shevet Binyamin and not from Shevet Yehuda. The reason being is that Binyamin had an overwhelming number of lefties. And in those days, if you were a lefty, you couldn't fight by with the sword because the swords were made for righties. They weren't made for lefties. And so the lefties became the archers because they were not the sword fighters. And Binyamin has a large number of itirei yad. That's what's mentioned with regards to the story both by Pelegish Bigiba and later on in Sefer Shmuel with regards to Binyamin. It seems that the archers came from Binyamin. So it's interesting here that the Gemara associates the archers with Yehuda and not with Shevet Binyamin. And now, Vayarem hatabach et ashok ve'he'aleha v'yasem lifnei Shaul. So here is a story in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph when Shaul loses some of his flock or animals that are grazing and he wants to go to the Navi Shmuel to find out where they are. Shmuel says that Shaul is going to come to him and that he's going to anoint Shaul as the king when he comes to him. So at that point, Shmuel prepares or has a feast prepared, and then he has Shaul sit with them amongst the people that are there, and he eventually anoints Shaul, and on that day, Shaul goes out and he's amongst the Bnei Nevi'im, and he's prophesying just like everybody else that's there. So as part of that story, it says, Vayikach Shmuel et Shaul ve'et Na'aro, ve'yem lishvata, ve'yitein lehem makom b'rosh ha'kruim, ve'yem ha'bishloshim ish. And then, Vayom Shmuel et Abach, Nat ha'manah she'natati lach, asher amarte elecha simota imach. Vayarem ha'tabach. The tabach seems to be the cook or the chef, whoever was providing the meat that was there. The butcher, Vayarem ha'tabach, et ha'shok. He took off the leg, ve'he'aleha. And that which was attached to it, that's the pashtut of pasuk, ve'yasem lifnei Shaul, and he brings it before Shaul, who is being seated at the table, or the head of the table, where Shmuel is having the zebach. What does it mean, ve'he'aleha? Rabbi Yochanan Amar, shok valya. It is the leg and then the tail that went with it. So now obviously aliyah is spelt with an aleph and not with an ayin. So what's the connection? My vehe aleha, the mismacha shok la aliyah. The shok holds up or gives support to the aliyah, to the tail. And that's why it's called vehe aleha. It's something that causes to be lifted up or causes to rise. The tail sits on top of the shok, and so the shok causes the tail to be at a higher point, and it rests upon it. So Rashi is describing over here the area of what seemingly is the hip or the hip bone, and then the thigh bone and the possibly the calf below it that are supporting it, and that's the shok that is supporting the aliyah, which is the tail that is behind it. Rabbi Elazar Omer, shok v'chazer. Ve'aleha means that which was on the shok, which was the chest. My ve'aleha. The machit la lechazeh ilavei the shok. Because you always put the chazeh, you always put the breast on top of the shok, on top of the leg. Kibai anufei minafile. Because you have to do a wave offering with it. Whenever you do a wave offering with a korban, the wave offering that's done with the korban takes the shok and the chazeh, which from the shlamim, the korban shlamim, belong to the kohen. Before you give it to the kohen, they do a wave offering with it. And the wave offering is done by putting one on top of the other. And over here, it is the chazeh that goes on top of the shok. And so that's what it means. The shok, v'he'aleha. The shok, and that which is normally on top of that, which is the shok, and that's the chazeh. As Rashi notes over here, even though normally when it comes to a korban, these belong to the kohanim. In this instance, it didn't go to the kohen, because we're talking about post-korban shiloh. Talking about a bamat yachid. And a bamat yachid, there's no din of tnufa, and there's no din of giving the kazev shok to the kohanim. That's the way Rashi deals with it. Others suggest over here that the zevach that we're speaking about here is not a zevach in terms of a korban, it's a zevach in terms of they were having a feast. And zevach also means not just zvachim in terms of korbanot, but zevach means anything that you shech. And something that is shechted would also be called a zevach, and that's what maybe he was speaking about here, and then you don't have to deal with what Rashi is speaking about, why was it going to them and not to the kohanim. Rishmo ba nachmani amar, shok v'shofi. It is the shok and the shofi, which we'll see in one second which it is, but it's the cap of the thigh bone. Mai v'aleha, shofi ilavei the shokoi. Because the cap of the hip bone, or the socket of the hip bone, sits above the shok. And in Rashi's description over here, he says, shofi is kafa yerech. It is the thigh socket. Hasovev etzem akolit. The hip socket in which the thigh bone turns. Korin pulpa. And it's called pulpa, I assume from the word pulp. The hip socket in which the thigh bone is tied, which it's a ball and socket joint. And that's what he's saying about the pulpa that's there. What's interesting about that is, if you go to the story in Parshat Vayishlach between Yaakov and the Malach, as to what happens there, it says that when the Malach cannot defeat Yaakov, Vayarki lo yacholo, Vayikach, Vekach, Yerecho. Then he hits him the kaf yerech, Vateka kaf yerech Yaakov, Yevkoimo. That dislocates what seemingly is Yaakov's hip when he hits him over there. And then it says later on, it says, Rashi over there says, Al kaf yarech, pulpa belaz, ko basar gvol etalul v'agul kari kaf. Any flesh or anything that's circular is called a kaf, kamo. So kaf is a shaping of the tendons or cartilage that make it into a harder area that sits on the basar. And so what Rashi here is describing is the pulpa, the same laaz that he uses by kaf yarech Yaakov, which indicate that we're speaking about here is the hip joint or the ball and socket where the thigh bone goes into the socket of the hip. So this finishes up the Agadata, which was tangential, but by association we brought in all of these items, as well as the fact that some of the individuals who argue about the definition of the psukim over here are the same individuals over and over again, which is Rav Shmuel ben Achmani and Rabbi Elazar, that they're arguing about the interpretation of the psukim. So we brought all these Agadata down. Now we go back to our Mishnah, which is Lotit Yachid Ishai Imahem. The second piece of the Mishnah, we first spoke about the Behemah, not leaving it alone with them, and that's what we've been discussing until now. Now we jump to the second halacha on the Mishnah, which is not allowed to leave a woman alone with them. Mar wants to understand, why is it just about Yichud with them? Seems to me that's something that would be applicable even to Israelim or Jews. But my askinan, what is the story here? Ilema Bechad Dekavata Gab Yisrael Mishari. If you're only speaking about one individual, then why is that even a question? Because even by Israel, you can't have Yichud. A one woman can't be together alone with a man, even if he's Israel. So why do you have to tell me in a Mishnah that you can't be alone together with a single Oved Kochavim? Ba'atzanan, don't we have our Mishnah in the end of Kiddushim? Lo yidyached ish echad im shtei nashim. That a single man cannot be alone with two women. Not only can he not be alone with one woman, he can't even be alone with two women. And it's Rashi brings over here, shnashim tatan kalot. Because they will both join in with this individual and have some underworld behavior go on between them, and they will allow it to happen between them. So that's not enough to have one man and two women. Ella bitlato. It has to be a case of three. The Mishnah in Kiddushin says a single man cannot be alone with two women, but what is allowed is two men with a single woman. That would be enough. Yet the Gemara over here goes to Ela Betzlata, goes to three. That is because the Mishnah and the Gemara there explain that when you're in the city, it's enough to have two men and one woman together, not to be classified as Yichud. On the other hand, when you go out into the field and you're traveling, you need three men and one woman in order for not to be Yichud. Because when you're out in the field, that some person may have to leave to go relieve themselves. And when they go, they have to move far away from the group, and then it will leave whoever's behind. You only have two men and one woman. When the one person goes to relieve themselves, then the one man and woman are going to be left alone. So that's why you always have to have three. So if one person goes to relieve themselves, the other two will be at the woman. So the Gemara jumps to three, where it's across the board. Everywhere, and everyone will agree, three men and one woman is not a problem of Yichud. So over here, the Gemara suggests that it's a case, Bitzlato.
It's a case where you have three individuals with the woman. By Israel, that'd be fine. That would not be classified as yichud. Over here, you have three akum together with the woman. That would be a problem. Where it says, wait a minute. The kavatag of Israel b'prutzim mishari. The Mishnah in Kiddushin makes a distinction between the quality of individual that's involved. But it's not. This is what we've been discussing. A single woman can be together with two men. That's qualified by Shmuel. That's only true when you're talking about upright, moral individuals. If you're talking about people who have no moral standards and that engage in this type of unrestrained type of behavior, then you can't even have 10. It's not going to help you. And then they bring an incident that took place. That 10 men came along and took her out in a bed, meaning that the woman pretended to pass away. They carried her out like they were going to bury the woman outside of the area. So 10 men got together and they took her out as if they're going to bury her. And then they had a party out there. So you see, even when there are multiple men involved, when they're putzim and they have no moral standards, here they're not only not problems of ichud, here they're planning and plotting to be in situations like this in order to do whatever they want. Where it says, lo tzricha bishto imo, the case where his wife is with him. That is a dispensation that we have in the halacha of ichud, which is that if a man's wife is with him, then there's no problem of ichud. So a person can be in a hotel, a motel, even with other women, as long as his wife is there, because we have a principle, ishto mishamrato, that his wife watches over him. But, ovi kochamim, ein ishto mishamrato. Vayisrael ishto mishamrato, but by Yisrael we do have that confidence that the wife will take care of it. The difference is that we can say that about a Jewish wife, she will make sure that her husband doesn't get involved in any activity that's problematic, but we don't have that same confidence in the wife of the ovi kochamim. And Rashi says the reason why the Ovedet Kochavim doesn't watch her husband so carefully is because it's a quid pro quo. She looks the other way when her husband does some of these things because she expects her husband to look the other way when she engages in that type of behavior. And therefore there's a quid pro quo between them. And so by a Jew, by Israel, if the woman is there together with the husband, then we have this concept of Ishto Mishamrato and there's no problems of Yichud. The extent of Ishto Imo is a question amongst the Poskim. Many of the Rishonim believe that Ishto Imo means literally. She has to be in the house with him. She needs to be present alongside of him in order for Ishto Imo to work. There are other Rishonim that give a slightly broader meaning to Ishto Imo, which somewhat then becomes similar to Bala Ba'ir, which is also a dispensation, which is that there's no Ichud when the husband is in the city. And that has to do with the fact that if the husband's in the city, the woman is loath or fearful of getting involved in anything because the husband can appear at any moment or show up. Her husband is local to her. In that case, Bala Be'ir is not about the husband being adjacent to the wife. It means the husband is in the locale where he can pop in at any time. Therefore, there's mirtat, there's fear of that. So there are many questions amongst the poskim as to whether that has application in reverse, which is Ishto Ba'ir, does that have the same effect? And that might have to do both with the difference in the mentality of men and women with regards to relations and these situations. Also, whether it has to do with culturally that women are more fearful of men than men are fearful of women, and maybe that's changed today. All of these factors go into what the poskim discuss about whether Ishto Ba'ir also has application. But then if you say Ishto Imo has a slightly broader definition, it starts to look a little bit like Bala Ba'ir if you allow Ishto Imo to have broader context than simply being in the same house as him. But generally, or the majority of Rishonim believe Ishto Imo means literally with him, and that Bala Ba'ir means within the city, and there is a difference between those two heterim. Now you would conclude from here that first of all, by Yisraelim that are Putzim, that Ishto Imo would be sufficient to prevent Yichud, because the Gemara drops that problem now when it says Ishto Imo. Number two is, it might have implications as to how many wives need to be there. Depending on what you think the Gemara did at this point, and the Gemara now reject the idea that there were three individuals there, and the woman, but now going back to the original assumption that it's one-on-one, and Ishto Imo protects him, then from that you can't conclude anything except the fact that the woman helps out in those situations. On the other hand, if you think we're continuing the thought process that there are three Ovdei Kochavim there,
along with the woman, we're just not saying that they're alone. There's also Ishto Imo. One of the wives is there together with them. Then you could possibly conclude, and the Rambam does make such a deal, that one wife being there is sufficient to protect against Yichud, even with the other individual, the other men that are there. That Ishto Mishamrato is not just that she protects against her husband, but the other men that are there, she also stops them from being Yichud. There are other poskim like the Tur who reject that view of the Rambam and say it doesn't make any sense. Ishto Mishamro is exactly that. She guards or takes care of her husband. She's not taking care of the other individuals there. And Ishto Mishamrato only applies to the individual whose wife is there. Tosfo does ask over here, why the Gemara doesn't use another option that we find in the Gemara in Kiddushin, is where you have a child who is old enough to tell or understand what is happening, but not old enough to be engaged or interested in any sexual relations. That type of child also prevents the problem of Yichud. Why doesn't the Gemara give that as the reasoning, which would be another solution to the problem? So Baal HaTos Vah answer is because the Lashona Mishnah, which says, Lo Titiached Imahen, makes it sound like she's the only one who's there, the only Jewish individual who's there, and that there's nobody else there with her, together with the Ovdei Kochavim. Therefore, that would preclude the possibility of there being a katan or katana there that would have obviated the problem of Yichud. So Mar says, "V'tipuklei mishom shfichut damim." Why are you worried about Yichud here and a problem of Arayot? Why don't you worry about what the Mishnah says later on is, that lo yitiyachedim hem, because they might kill you. There's a fear of shfichut damim when you're alone with them. Why don't you have that same application by the woman? Why are you only worried about Arayot and Yichud in the sense of the sexual implications of that? Why don't you have a worry about the Shvichut Tamim that would come from it and say Lo Yitiyachet because of that problem? Amar Rav Yirmiya, Bisha Chashuva Askinan. We're dealing with a woman who has a significant presence or of stature, Dimirtate Mino, that they are afraid of her. So there will be no problem of Shvichut Tamim, because if this woman gets killed, she has enough stature or political standing that they're going to be brought to trial or they're going to be taken to task for killing this woman. So in terms of killing her, they're afraid. In terms of relations, over there, they don't have any problem trying to seduce this woman or getting this woman involved. So therefore, there is still a problem of Yichud from the relations standpoint. Vidi Amar Isha Klei Zayna Aleha. It says that the woman's weapon is on her. We have this in the Gemara in Yivamot. The terminology there is used with regards to a shvuya, that isha klei zayna aleha. Over here, I'll just give you the broad difference in opinions about what this is. Rashi claims isha klei zayna aleha means that she has something to offer besides just being a victim. That is, that a man has nothing to offer. So the goy or the akum will kill him without keeping him around, because he doesn't serve any purpose when he keeps him around, so he'll kill her. The woman, on the other hand, he can rape her, he can sleep with her. So that gives him a reason to keep the woman around, meaning that klei zayna aleha means that her weapon is on her. That means she has something to provide, she has something to offer the goy, or the akum, and therefore he won't kill her. And that's what protects her over here, that's klei zayna aleha. That's the view of Rashi. The Baalei HaTosafot over here disagree with that explanation of Rashi, and they say that the meaning of Isha Klei Zayna Aleha means that a woman does not go to battle, does not carry a weapon outside of herself. And so what it means is that generally people are merachim on women. When it comes to fighting in battles or in war, people are generally see the woman as being someone who is defenseless, someone who is not a part of the military efforts, and therefore they spare the woman and they don't kill the woman because they see her as being a helpless soul or someone that is deserving of mercy. And that's why they don't kill her. So that's what it means, klei zayna aleha, which is that she doesn't carry a weapon. Her only weapon is herself. She doesn't have anything to fight back with, and therefore they're not going to kill her. That's the view of the Baalei Tosfot. And the Raifud brings a third possibility, which is klei zayna aleha, is that the woman's beauty makes her appealing to keep around, even without this issue of biyah and sleeping with her. Just because the woman is beautiful, that's enough of a reason for them not to kill her, that there's something understood in the beauty of such a woman that they would be reluctant or reticent to kill such a woman. Now, my benayu, what's the difference between the reasoning of Rav Yirmiya and Rav Yehudi. Ike b'nayu, the difference between them is Isha chashuva ben anashim, Sheina chashuva ben anashim. That she has stature or standing amongst the men, but doesn't have standing amongst the women. Two major ways to read this Gemara. That is the Rashi and the Balei Tosafot. Rashi, as we mentioned before, says that the reason the woman doesn't get killed is because they can rape her, they can be ma'aneser, so they may as well keep her around. There's no reason to kill her when they can enjoy her presence. And so now it says that the difference between these two opinions is in a case where there's one woman who has political standing or stature amongst the men, but has no standing amongst the women. Rashi over here does something that almost every Rishon disagrees with and says that this is speaking about one woman, and the question is she a beautiful woman or is she not a beautiful woman? Her standing amongst other women means where is she in her hierarchy versus other women out there? Is she a beautiful woman and sits way above the other women? Or is she an Isha Mechuera? Is she an ugly woman and therefore she has no standing amongst the women? And so what he says over here is that the Ike Benayu is a case where she has political stature. She has standing amongst the men, which means that if they killed her, they'd be in trouble. On the other hand, Isha Eina Chashuva Ben Anashim. She's not important amongst the women, means that she is not beautiful. She's not someone that is appealing or attractive. Rashi sets up three examples, and we'll understand what the difference is. In Yirmiyah's position, he says, if the woman is Chashuva Ben Anashim, meaning that she is important both in the eyes of the men and the women, which means Isha Yafa Ukrova L'Malchut, it means a beautiful woman who has political connections, then over there, mistafemina, they are afraid of her, velokadlila, they will not kill her. Aval mishum arayot, ika. But with regards to arayot, there is a problem with the alfahi, because she's beautiful and appealing, and that's why she can't be mityachet. Kashina shema titpata, because we're afraid that they will try to seduce her, or they'll try to encourage her to engage in this behavior. Aval, the second type of woman is, Isha she'ena chashuva ben anashim, v'chashuva ben anashim. A woman who has no political standing, no stature whatsoever, but she is a beautiful woman, there mishum ritzika namiika. There we worry about her being killed as well, because she holds no political clout. That means that they might kill her as well. And in that situation, he's going to rape her and then kill her, because he has no fear at all. She's beautiful, so he has incentive to rape her. On the other hand, she has no political backing, so if he kills her, nobody's going to say a peep. So therefore, in that case, we worry about her being there, not only because of the arayot problem, we worry about her being killed. The third type of woman is that she's chashuva ben anashim. She's important amongst the men. She has political clout. Velo ben anashim. She's not a beautiful woman. She's an ugly woman. Here he says, muteret lehit yachid. According to Rashi, you're allowed to have yichud in this case. Mishum arayot leka deno yafa. There's no problem with Ariot because she's an ugly woman. She has political clout, so they won't kill her. She's an ugly woman, so they won't rape her or they won't be involved with her. So that case, Yichud is permitted. And that's the Ika Benayu case now, which is Rabbi Yirmiyah on this case, where she has political clout but is ugly. There was no problem of Yichud. Whereas for Rabbi Yehudi, who says the problem is that they are Klei Zayna Aleha, which means that she is an object of desire. She's someone who can be raped. Ravidi says we always worry about erva, as Rashi says over here, klei zayin aleha, which means that the woman becomes an object and he can use her for biyah, and that will apply whether she's pretty or ugly, it doesn't really matter, and that will be the nafkamina between them. So over here, the Balei Tosafot take on the explanation of Rashi on three points. The first point, which is something that I'm sure all of you noticed right away and chuckled a little bit about it, which is, where do we ever see in Chazal or in Shas that it makes a difference whether a woman is beautiful or not beautiful? The instance that they bring, or all the Rishonim note, is by Shvuya. When a woman is in captivity, we don't say there's a difference between a woman who's beautiful in captivity and a woman who's ugly in captivity. If we're choshesh for the fact that she had biyah with the captors, that's true whether she's pretty or not pretty, that distinction is not made at all. And so where does Rashi come up with this distinction between a beautiful woman and an ugly woman? So that's the first claim against Rashi, which is this distinction that he's making between Isha Yafa and Isha Mechueret. We don't find any such differentiation or distinction made in Chazal. And Tosva does point out that the Gemara before said that Bamtan, Shalot Yukokhavim, are even more appealing to them than Nishotehem. If that's the case, they're not so discerning. And why does it matter if the woman's pretty or not? Although the Ramban, in defense of Rashi, does say that it might be that they are so drawn or lustful towards the animals that that has more appeal to them than a woman who is not appealing, like an older woman or a woman who is ugly. Maybe they would have no interest in that. The second thing that they point out is that in the Ikebenayu, the phraseology is incorrect. It says there, Isha chashuva ben anashim, b'she'ena chashuva ben anashim. If Rashi is right that this is speaking about one woman, the phrase should have been this, that she's chashuva ben anashim, b'ena chashuva ben anashim. The fact that it repeats b'she'ena shows that we're speaking about two different women and not one woman. Rashi claims over here that it's one woman, and truthfully it seems like Rashi's girsa was that Rashi's girsa actually read Isha chashuva ben anashim, ve'ena chashuva ben anashim. That's the second criticism of the Baalei Tosfot. The third criticism of the Baalei Tosfot is, we never find the term chashuva and yafa being conflated or being synonyms. Where do you ever find that a chashuv, a woman of distinction, means a woman who is beautiful? The two are not synonymous, and the Gemara never uses the term chashuva when it's speaking about a beautiful woman. And when it's speaking about someone who's of a stature, it doesn't say yafa, it says chashuva. And so Tosfot says the wrong term is being used over here. If you want to speak about a beautiful woman, you would have said isha yafa. You speak about isha chashuva, that always means a woman who's of import, someone, a woman who has standing or stature. For that reason, the Baalei Tosfot disagree with Rashi, and therefore they reread the whole Gemara over here, according to their view of what the positions of Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Idi are, and then bring the nafkaminot between them. And that I mentioned already earlier, that the Baalei Tosfot believe that klei zayin alah means that they have rachamim, that they have mercy on the woman. And that's what it means, klei zayin alah. Rabbi Yirmiyah believes that the only reason they don't kill her is because she is chashuva. On the other hand, Rabbi Idi says they won't kill her whether she's chashuva or not chashuva because they don't have rachamim. Klei zayin alah, they always have rachamim on the woman, and they won't kill the woman. V'achi peirusho, and this is the way to explain it now, which is, Ika be'nau isha chashuva ben anashim, krova l'machut. One of the distinctions or differences between them is when you have an important woman who has political clout. Im muter li t'yachedim anashim odei kochavim, can't she be alone? Rabbi Yirmiyah asura. According to Rabbi Yirmiyah, it's a problem, because yes, we do not worry about shvichut damim, because she's an isha chashuva, but in terms of arayot, we do worry about her because of arayot. Ravidi Sharia. In Ravidi's case, it is mutar because the Amar time of the lekel meichah shvichut damim the shaklei zayna umirach meyala. The reason that we don't worry about the woman being killed is because they have mercy on her; they don't kill her. Aval arayot ikal meichah kashi chashuva. But when by arayot you don't have to worry when she's chashuva, the mirtat mina after arayot ocholshinat. Now that she's an isha chashuva, on top of the fact that she's a woman, that gives you the additional protection against arayot. Rav Yirmiyah only sees isha chashuva as being a protection against murder, not as a protection against arayot. Rav Idi, who says the protection against murder is that she's a woman. Qua woman, doesn't matter if she's chashuva or not. Now isha chashuva adds on an additional dimension which gives her protection from arayot. They're too scared to start up with her. They're too scared to rape or even seduce her because of her political clout. And by the way, you have situations or circumstances like that in the reverse, in stories about matrinot. The matrons of Rome were through these women who were very significantly politically placed in Rome. And we have stories of the chachamim visiting them, and they're soliciting the chachamim to sleep with them. And they jump out windows, they do all sorts of things to escape, because this isha chashuva carries such political clout, she can make such demands, which shows you that even in the realm of arayot, that these women carried weight, and that's what Rav Idi is suggesting, that when she's an isha chashuva, arayot is off the table. If she ain't a chashuva, there's a second nafkamina between them, if she ain't a chashuva ben anashim, when she doesn't have any political clout, not with men and not even with women, she's just a plain Jane woman. In that case, is she muteret l'tiyached ben anashim? Is she allowed to be amongst the women who are avdot kochavim? So now, according to Rabbi Yirmiyah, since she's not a chashuva, the women will kill her. The women of the kochavim will kill her because she has no status amongst the women. And therefore, she's in danger, she's mitiyached. Whereas according to Rabbi Idi, Sharia, the klei zayin alah, kolmar demirach me'alah. Even women are merachim on other women. They don't kill each other, they don't kill women. And therefore, there's no problem of shvichut damim. And what about the problem of arayot? Now, obviously, with the women themselves, there's no problem of arayot. But the problem is that we saw earlier in the Gemara that men are frequent visitors by other people's wives or by other women. And there, they're willing to take up the women, the animals, anybody that's there. So she's at risk just because she's amongst women and an Ovid Kochavim could show up. But Dati, she's different than an animal. Shetir'eshi of Ovid Kochavim teitzei miyad. Ovid Kochavim shows up. When a man shows up to the party of all women over here, then she's going to take off and she'll leave. Or the Rebbe Tosfot bring from Yushalmi that she'll be able to blend in. When it comes to the other women, she can make herself unobtrusive or not so visible, and therefore she can hide herself and get herself out of the problem. And then the Bali Tosfot also bring an additional distinction, which is brought by Yushalmi, which he then connects to his own explanation, which is the difference between an Isha Chashuva means an Isha Baria, means a strong woman who can protect herself and has a mechanism of self-defense, versus a regular woman who's not chashuva, or a woman who is not strong enough that she can defend herself. And Klei Zayin Ale is a woman who does not have the ability to defend herself, but she can meld in. She can make herself non-distinct from the non-Jewish women, and that way she can hide herself and say that I'm Ovedet Kochavim, say I'm not unique. She can make herself unobtrusive or not spectacular, which a man can't do, whether that's because the man has a milah, which will automatically make him distinct, or whether because the way that the dress and the haircuts of the men, it would be clear who is a Jew and who is not a Jew, versus the woman who can be much more unobtrusive, because in their day, all the women dressed in a tzanua fashion, so it wasn't necessarily something unique that this woman was dressed in a tzanua fashion, or that she covered her hair, because that it was also the practice amongst the non-Jews at that time as well. And that's what the difference between Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Bone in the Yerushalmi. And therefore, Isha Chashuva ben Anashim, meaning that a woman is really strong and can defend herself, then for Rabbi Yirmiyah, it's still a sur, because yes, she can defend herself and there won't be Shvichut Damim, but we still worry about Shema Titpata, that maybe she will be seduced. Rabbi Idi, who doesn't worry about being seduced, but rather just about being raped, if she is strong, then it's mutar, because she can defend herself both against shvichut damim, as well as against rape, and therefore we don't worry about it. Or, in a situation, she'ena chashuva ben anashim, she's not important amongst the women, meaning that she's not even strong amongst the women, she's defenseless. Nevertheless, Rabbi Idi says she's fine, because she can hide herself, or she can make herself unobtrusive, and therefore there's no reason to worry about shvichut damim, and there's no reason to worry about arayot, because she's amongst women. And according to Rabbi Yirmiyah, we worry about Shvichut Damim in that case because she's not strong enough to defend herself and therefore she'll be exposed to them. So those are three different ways to explain this Gemara, but the real fundamental difference between them is first of all how you explain the meaning of Klei Zayna, as well as whether you think being beautiful or not beautiful has any impact. And the last thing is whether the nafkamino that are brought here is one nafkamina about one single woman who is both Chashuva amongst the men, but not Chashuva amongst the Nashim? Or is it two nafkaminot, like the Balei HaTosafot suggests over here? Tanya Kavendi Rav Idi Bavin, we have a brighter that supports Rav Idi Bavin's contention, Aisha Afu Pisha Shalom Ima, Lo Tityachin Vimehem Ibnei Shechashudim Al Arayot. So even though the woman has peace with her, she is protected by herself. The fact that she's a woman brings her peace. Nevertheless, she should now not be Mityachin Vimehem. She should not be alone with the men, because of the problem of arayot that exists in these situations. So you see here that the reason to think the woman would be protected is because of shalom ima, that she has some defense mechanism, which means that she won't get killed. Nevertheless, lo titiachin ima, because of the arayot, which is exactly what Rav Idi says, which is that because she, according to Rashi, can be raped, according to Balei HaTosafot, they have rachamim on her, they're not going to kill her. That's not the issue, but the issue is the arayot aspect of it, which is there, they will take advantage of the woman. Right? Lo yitiyached adam imahem. A man should not be alone with them. Tan Rabbanan, Yisrael shenizdam lein lo oved kochavim baderech, toflo lemino. So here, the Gemara brings a braita, in which many of the Rishonim latch onto and say, that since you're not allowed to be alone with them, the only instance where that will happen is if by chance, you're traveling and all of a sudden a goy shows up and now you're alone with the goy on the derech. Because the mission says, "L'chatzilah lo yitiachedu mehem," you can't be alone. The only time it's going to happen is in a situation where you're not in control of the environment, like when you're traveling, and all of a sudden there's a goy who joins you and wants to walk with you and to be company together. So there it says, keep him to your right side. Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broko Omer, from Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broko's statement, you'll understand what the Tanakhama says is, b'sayif toflo lemino, he's carrying a sword, keep him to your right side. B'makel, he's carrying a stick or a staff, toflo lesmolo, you should keep him to your left side. Again, over here, it's not clear whether Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broko is arguing on the Tanakhama, which seems to be the simple way to read it, or whether he's defining, he is qualifying the statement of the Tanakhama and saying where it applies. Now, what he's speaking about here is that when a person is wearing a sword, the sheath for the sword is on their left side, and then when they draw the sword, you draw the sword across the body, and therefore you use your right hand to fight with the sword, but it's placed on your left side. So the reason to keep the guy on your right side is because the sheath of the sword is on his left side. So if you are close to his left side because you keep him to your right, then you always will see when his hand goes to the sheath, you have the ability to stop him with your right hand. You'll be able to defend yourself right away and stop him from pulling the sword out. That is the reason that Eglon Melech Moav was not afraid or not worried about Ehud ben Gera, because he was a lefty and he wore his sword on the right side of his hip, and therefore he didn't expect him to pull the dagger or the sword out. That was almost an indication, and you can see that in old times, when a person wanted to come in and meet someone and show they're not coming for battle, they used to switch the sheath to the right side, because you can't draw your sword when it's close to you. That was an indication they were coming in a peaceful way. So that's exactly what happens with Ehud ben Gera. He comes in what looks like a peaceful manner, but he's a lefty, and they don't realize that, and he's able to draw across his body because he is a lefty. He's an Iter Yad Yemini. So that's what it's saying over here. Since the sheath is on the left side, make sure that you keep him to your right. The other hand, when it comes to a makel, a stick or a staff, he doesn't have in a sheath, he carries that in his hand, his right hand. So in order to protect yourself, you gotta keep him to your left. Because it's his right hand that's holding the stick, you gotta be close to that stick if he's gonna raise it or do something. You wanna have the hand that's immediately there to defend yourself, not allow him to draw it on the other side and come across and hit you, so you wanna keep him to your left in that case. The Tanakhama might be arguing that you always want to keep him to your right side because your right arm is stronger. If you keep him on your left, yes, you'll be closer to when he's trying to raise the makel, but it's going to be your left hand against his right hand, and that's a harder defense, so therefore it's keep him to your right all the time. So that's the suggestion about how to deal with them. If they are climbing up an area where, again, they're single file, or they're descending an area where they're single file, lo yisrael demato. The Jew should never be the lower one. And the ultimate kuchavim above. Now when you're descending, it makes a lot of sense, because if you're descending and you're the one in front, he can jump on you from the back. Now in the other way around, when you're ascending, the Gemara says, don't let him go in front, because if he goes in front, he can turn around and have the advantage of being on the upper side or the heights, which always is an advantage when in battle, being on the higher side is the one who has the advantage. I would have said that you could have argued that he might stab you in the back. And that's the problem that we're worried about. And that's why on the descent, you should keep him in front of you. But that would mean on the ascent, he should also be in front of you and not behind you. That's not what the Gemara worries about here. You should always have the upper hand. You should be on the higher location, because that's always easier to defend when you're on the upper side. You shouldn't bend over in front of him. Shem Yerud said, Google it up, because maybe you'll smash your skull. He'll break your skull open. Shalul Eichan Olech. They ask him, where are you going to? So this is like today, when people go into a tramp, and they ask you where you're heading, one of those problems is that you don't want to be the initiator. Whoever is the initiator, in a sense, is as the lower hand. That's why the driver always asks the person where you're going, and the guy who's getting in always asks where the driver where they're going, because they want to assess the situation. So if they ask you where you're going, yarchiv lo aderech, you should tell them a destination that is much further than you really want to go to. The same way that Yaakov dealt with Esav, Yaakov over there, when he says to Esav, we don't need your help, we can't keep up with your pace, why don't you go ahead, and then I'll meet you in Seir later on. And that Yaakov only went to Sukkot, he never went to Seir. So, in essence, what he was doing was throwing himself off and saying, I'm going to get to Seir eventually, and you'll meet me in Seir. But he never intended to go to Seir. So that's where the Gemara explains it over here, that Yaakov was, in a sense, deceiving Esav and saying to him, I'll come to Seir, but he's never intending to go there because he wanted to throw Esav off his track. And therefore he sends him ahead and says, when I get there, but he never intended to get there. There is an alternate opinion that says, how could it be that Yaakov didn't tell the truth to Esav? Although it's a reference to the Sukkim that are found in Avadja, Balayu, Moshiach, Baratzion, Mishpatar Esav, that Yaakov did not lie. He believed that he was coming to Esav and he was coming to Har Seir. Latid Lavo, that he was speaking about the future and he wasn't necessarily lying. Those are two opinions. Rashi and Chumash, in commenting on the pasuk, brings both interpretations, both Lishanot, as if he's melding them together. One was that he was pushing him off, and the other one that he was coming Latid Lavo. And what Rashi's trying to do is that it, you say is Yaakov was deceiving Esav in the near term, but he was still telling the truth because eventually he will get there, Bizman HaMashiach, which would bring you to the conclusion that even when you do have to lie, you do it in a way that has some sense of truth to that which you are saying. And that's the way of the Bali Musar in general, which is that if they can find a way that it's not a lie, then they will prefer to do that, even though it's clearly that there's deception. And they do that with Yaakov and the Brachot as well, where he's saying that I am Esav, and then they try to parse the language and say, I'm Yaakov, Esav is Bechorcha, is your Bechor. So they try to make it into a way that it's like he's not lying. Obviously, he is deceiving, but they want to make it that the deception's done in a way that it is a partial truth, or a truth taken out of context, and that's what makes it into a lie, because the Bali Musar prefer that people don't engage in lying at all. We've seen that before in the Rabbeinu Yonah in his explanation to Masechet Avot, where he says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, that one has to distance themselves from any lying, that's even lying in a joking manner, even lying when there's no repercussions to it. Truth is that there may only be an Isser of lying where there are ramifications to the lying, meaning that monetary or other ramifications that happen, like the Torah prosecutes someone who lies under oath or lies about a monetary obligation, those are the people that are punished. That doesn't mean lying otherwise is allowed. This may not be the Isser Doraita that we're thinking about, but there might be a moral and Musar issue with lying, Midivrei Kabbalah, and or Midivrei Chachamim, and over there, we say that a blanket, that one should not lie at all. But in instances or circumstances where there's Sakanat Nefashot, we would give a dispensation to lie, because here, the person's life is at risk. Maaseh B'Talmidei Rabbi Akiva, there was an incident with the students of Rabbi Akiva, Shayochim Lechziv, they were going to Chziv, Pag'u Behem Listin, some marauders caught up with them, so they said to them, where are you going? Akko, which was much further than Ksiv, they told them their further destination. When they reached Ksiv, Pershu, they said, goodbye, we're taking off, we're done, we're stopping here. Amrulehen, Tamidei Miyatem. Who are you the students of? Amrulehen, Tamidei Rabbi Akiva. They said, we are the students of Rabbi Akiva. Amrulehen, Ashrei Rabbi Akiva Tamidav, Shaloba Gabahem Adam Rami Olam. And praise be worthy or lucky are the students of Rabbi Akiva that no bad person ever took advantage of them any time. Which is here that they were able to protect themselves by using the advice of the Chachamim, and they were taught to lie about going to a further place and then exiting early, because what the Goy plans is on the longer trip, he'll take his time and do it towards the end of the trip, and then you pull off earlier, then he won't have his opportunity to kill you. And that's what they did here. The Listim had planned to either kill them or take all their possessions, but they exited in Ksiv before they ever had a chance to do it, because they had their plans all the way to Akko. And here they're praising them and praising Rabbi Akiva for teaching them how to get out of the problem. Some people ask, how is it true that these Listim over here say, Asher Rabbi Akiva Tamidav Shlo Pogabein Adam Rami Olam, when Rabbi Akiva was one of the Asura Harugei Malchut. And then Adam Ra was Pogaya in Rabbi Akiva. So they suggest, and this is based somewhat on the Gemara that we saw before with Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, that Rabbi Akiva brought it on himself. And that he was Makil Kilot Berabim. It wasn't that somebody came. He made it a decision. And again, we spoke about that maybe even two strands of thought amongst the Chachamim had to deal with Rome. And Rabbi Akiva made the choice, like Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, to teach Torah in public, despite the Gzeirah. And so in that sense, he brought it upon himself. It wasn't that Pagaba Adam Ra. And that's how they distinguish between this statement over here versus the fact that Rabbi Akiva was killed by Sir Arugei Malchut. Rav Menashe Hava Azo, the Bay Torta. Rabbi Menashe was traveling to Beit Torta. Pagu Bei Ganve. These thieves caught up with him. Amrulei La'an Kazalt. They asked him, where are you going to? Amrulei the Pumpadita. So even though he was going to Beit Torta, he told him Pumpadita, which is a further place. Kimata the Beit Torta Parish. They got to Beit Torta. He took a turn and said, I'm heading into the city. I'm going over here. Amrulei Tamida Yehuda Ramat. Are you the student of the deceiving Yehuda, referring to Rabbi Yehuda, the Talmud Chacham? Amalu Yedit Olei? So Rashi translates Yedit Olei Shehu Ramai. You know that he is a deceiver, a person who is not truthful? Although if you look in the Rabbeinu Chananel, he says, Amalu Yedit Olei V'Rama'ak Karit Olei? He says, you know Rabbi Yehuda, you know the Gadol Ador, and you're calling him a conniving, cunning, misleading individual? Now you're going to be put into excommunication because you spoke disparagingly about the Gadol Ador, Rav Yehuda. And now when he puts him into Shamte, it's not just that he's excommunicated them, he's excommunicated them that he should be subject to the klala that is associated with the Shamta. And that's what Rashi explains over here, Vishaya Adam Gadol Bishamte, Chaylo Laitinu Bishamte. That he wasn't really putting them into excommunication because it would have no meaning here. These aren't people who are in the mainstream of society, but rather because he is a great person, you should be affected by the curse that would emanate for the offense that you created towards this Gadol Ador, Rabbi Yehuda. Azlu avdu gnevota esrim betarte mishnin. For 22 years, they were thieves, robbing, stealing, below atzlichu, and they were not successful. You would think before they got to 22 years, they would have quit. But they were unsuccessful the whole 22 years because of this curse and the shamta of Rav Menashe. Kevin dachazu, once they realized that nothing was going for them, atakulu, betavulu shrul, shumaitayu. They went and requested or beseeched the chachamim to release them from the shamta because they realized that it was having an impact on them. Baba bukhad girdana. Amongst them there was one weaver. He didn't come to have himself released from the Shamta. And then Achle Arya, and he was eaten by a lion. To show you the one who didn't care, didn't make the effort to go and take care of it, he was the one who was killed. Hadu Damre Inshe, that's what people say. Girdana Lo Taizan Shata Batsir Mishnei. So here Rashi explains that a weaver, the Lo Taizan, who's not an Anav, a weaver that's not humble, and Rashi says, Stam Gardan ain't Lo Boshet Panin. Most weavers are pretty haughty. Then he's going to end up shata batsir mishane. He loses years or a year from his life. The Baalei Tosafot, on the other hand, want to bring the explanation of the Aruch versus Rashi. Say girdana lo daizan. He says perish kuntus anav uba aruch garis girdana delachie. You can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel. Amra papa anu damre itche girdana delayit mazle shata bitzirle min shnei. That a weaver whose mazle is bad or is cursed will lose time or duration from his lifetime. And you can see the Baalei Tosafot say that it's a similar concept. Kolomar batar hanya azle aniuta. That the poverty follows the poor. Or over here, the individual who is already in bad shape because he has bad mazle. Not only would the bad mazel affect them, you also have a shortened lifespan. And now the Gemara says the moral of the story. That's why we all live in Eretz Yisrael. Tachazi men ganve bovel velistin Eretz Yisrael. See what the difference is between the ganavim in Bavel versus the listim in Eretz Yisrael. The ganavim in Bavel, when Rav Menashe shook them off, cursed Rav Yehuda, cursed the Gadol Ador. The listim, who are worse than ganavim. Ganavim are thieves. The steam are marauders and killers, and yet, despite the fact that they were worse, in Eretz Yisrael, when the people shook them off, they said, "Who's Talmidim are you are?" And they said, "Rabbi Akiva," and then they praised Rabbi Akiva for teaching them that. So you see here the greatness of Eretz Yisrael, that even the listim in Eretz Yisrael have respect for Rabbi Akiva, versus the ganavim in Bavel, who don't even have respect for the Gadol Hador. And that's to tell you the great praise, or the effect, or the hashpa that Eretz Yisrael has, even on the worst of individuals. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Chavav Amud Aleph.